So,
let's go back for a moment. Let's go back for a moment to the death of Theodor Herzl. It was in 1904. He was only 44 years old. Obviously, a very premature death. He'd accomplished a tremendous amount in, let's see, his book came out, The Jewish State came out in 1895. So it had only been 9 years that he was on the world stage, not even a decade. And you think of all that he did and the way his name is remembered today. He left a Zionist movement that was somewhat in disarray. He was the godfather of political Zionism. Objectively, political Zionism in its first 9 years was a failure. Right? The Zionist organization was ostensibly bankrupt. Herzl had poured his own money into it. He had certainly used his own money to keep Die Welt, the Zionist daily newspaper, going. There was no charter of the nations, and there was no site. Remember, he had met with the Turkish Sultan a few times, but nothing had happened there, unfortunately. There was a revolt starting within the ranks because of the cultural Zionists. The settlements weren't particularly thriving. The argument could be made that as glorious as they are in terms of the way we recall them today, that if it wasn't for the Baron's money, the known unknown benefactor, Baron Rothschild, there would have been no settlements. Two-thirds of the settlements were started by the Baron, not by other pioneers. And he was the one who was really bankrolling them. And he maintained the bankrolling through his PICA, it was called, the Palestine something collective agency. I'm not sure what the I was for. I think it might have been a French terminology. And there was also a great fear that the Zionist organization was going to fall apart, because you have a guy like Herzl, who is so dominant. And remember, one of the criticisms of Herzl is that he's autocratic. And indeed, he was autocratic, but for a noble cause, and he was getting things done where nobody else probably could have gotten anything done. But could anyone come in and step in and take his spot? There was a big split. We mentioned it briefly during the Echad HaAm lecture. There was something called the Democratic Fraction. The Democratic Fraction formed in 1901. It was ostensibly a group of cultural Zionists, of people who were going to wind up becoming practical Zionists, which we're going to see is focused on the building of the Land of Israel. They wanted democratization. They were out to get Herzl in some regards, to get him off his high horse. They thought he was taking the movement down the wrong path, that he wasn't allowing younger Zionists who were now starting to come into the movement to be active. One of its leaders was a young man named Chaim Weizmann, who we're going to learn a lot about tonight. So Chaim Weizmann, if you think about it, was active on the Zionist stage from 1901 until 1952, when he passed away. And here, I showed some people earlier, I have his autobiography. I highly recommend this book for anybody who's interested. It's called Trial and Error, and it really gets into a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with, because he was on the stage for so long, you know, particularly from the founding of the Zionist movement forward. Weizmann, by the way, was at every Zionist Congress, with the exception of the first one because of travel snafus, until his death, until 1952. So from 1898 until 1951, he was at World Zionist Congresses. And that's a tremendous span, and he had a tremendous impact. But more on him in a little bit later. The Democratic Fraction also wanted immediate settlement in Palestine as a goal. Remember, that wasn't Herzl's goal. He didn't think it was a good idea. In fact, what was the terminology that they used? I can't remember the exact terminology that they used, but they basically said that it was subterfuge against the Turks, and it would turn the Turks, the settlement, it would turn the Turks against the Zionist movement, because Herzl was in a precarious negotiating position with the Turks. They also wanted a lot of cultural activities, the cultural Zionism. They wanted an emphasis on the diaspora. Herzl wasn't that interested in the diaspora. Herzl really thought, was one of the people that thought that some were going to stay in the diaspora, but, you know, millions are going to wind up in Palestine, Israel, the Land of Israel, whatever you want to call it. They also demanded separation of religion and state. Now, this is very interesting, because this is something that's coming, you know, it's an undercurrent throughout the Zionist organization. These are all, they're primarily Eastern European Jews. They're people like Weizmann and Leo Motzkin and Shmaria Levin, who all grew up observant and left it, and they didn't want to see it come back. Remember, we talked about this with Chada'am. These were people who didn't say, I don't really feel like being a religious Jew, so I'm just going to go out in the world and be who I am. These people said, I don't feel like being a religious Jew, but I'm still a Jew. Nothing can change that. The world won't let me forget it. I have this imprint of how the world brands me a Jew no matter what I'm going to do anyway. So I need to invent something new. I need to invent Hebrew culture, and I need to promote it. And it needs to not just be in the land of Israel. It needs to be all over the place. And in fact, this is a group that one of the things that it would do is it created a thing called Hebrew schools in Europe. Now, we know Hebrew schools in America are associated with synagogues, but they weren't originally that. They were originally about Hebrew culture. And again, it's different in Europe where, you know, you have a multitude of different types of schools springing up, particularly in the Jewish communities, and some with boys and girls going to school together, which was another innovation. The religious Zionists, by the way, which we're starting to see at this moment, are getting upset as well, because they're saying, we don't want you doing cultural activities. We want you doing religious activities. That's what you should be funding. And we don't want men and women mixing together. Right? There's very little of this, what we call modern orthodoxy, at this point. We had seen it with Samson Raphael Hirsch. We had talked about that in Germany a few lectures ago. But certainly from Eastern Europe, there's very little of that. But there are some part and parcel Zionist Orthodox rabbis. We're going to have a whole unit on religion and Zionism. But there are people like Mulhover, certainly Rabbi Cook or Rav Cook. Those are the big names. And Rabbi Pinus, we'll get to all that. So what did the Democratic Fraction do? They're only in existence until about 1914, I believe. The war, which started in Europe in 1914, changed everything. They started studying this thing called cooperative settlements. And this thing called cooperative settlements, then known as the Kvutza, not yet called the kibbutz, lekabetz is to gather in Hebrew. In 1909, the Ganya Aleph was the first kibbutz that was founded. It was named for an Arab village called Serej just before that, but it changed its name to the Ganya Aleph. Dagan means grain or oat in Hebrew, so that speaks obviously of the agricultural focus. They created, the Democratic Fraction, a fund for a university in Palestine, a Hebrew university. Now, the Hebrew university wouldn't have its cornerstones laid, or its grand opening, I should say, its cornerstones were laid earlier, wouldn't have its grand opening until 1925. But it was beginning back here. This is when the idea came into being. And Weizmann was a huge advocate of this. They wanted more democracy in the philanthropies, like JNF. Right now, at this moment, we're still with Herzl being alive, and then even the years right after he's alive, there's a cabal of leadership that gets to decide everything. And if you run the JNF, you were picked by Herzl, or you were picked by his successor, David Wilson, and you got pretty much to do what you wanted to do. These guys said, that's not right, that's not a way to perpetuate a movement, we need some democracy. So, what we see is that the movement is splitting as Herzl dies. Doesn't mean it would have split in half. It means that there were real factions / fractions that had appeared. There were the religious, there were the cultural, and there were the political. And they all knew that they had the right way to go. And Zionist congresses were not necessarily easy places to be. And in fact, Herzl had created a system where there was a smaller actions committee and a greater actions committee, which met frequently during, or periodically during the year. The smaller actions committee was kind of the group of 5, 6, or 7 people, depending on when it was, who made all the big decisions. The greater actions committee, 20, 25 people, made recommendations to them, and they would report back to the congresses. Not very democratic in its faction. However, if any of you have ever seen a Knesset debate, sometimes you do question the validity of democracy in terms of getting something done. Has anybody ever seen a tape of a Knesset debate in Israel? They scream at one another. They hurl insults. You know the old joke. I went to a Knesset debate and a hockey game broke out. The fight in the hockey game. I refer to it as Israel's raucous democracy. It's even crazier when you get some of the Arab legislators screaming certain things. Now, in the early days of the state, you don't have it anymore. But in the late 40s and the early 50s. You had Jewish legislators calling each other Nazis. You know, you can't imagine that today. But That was a big insult for obvious reasons back then. All right. So who did take over for Herzl? A man named David Wolfson. See, I think I have a picture of him. Let's see. This is actually, Wolfson's in here. This is the Zionist delegation in Jerusalem in 1898. Remember, Herzl went in 1898. Wolfson's a confidant of Herzl's. And you can see how out of place these guys must have been in Palestine in that day, in the rough and rocky era, wearing their tuxedos. So, let's see. Here's Herzl. This is Wolfson right here. It's kind of hard to see. Not many pictures of him were available. I don't know if that's a dedication of something or the standing of something, or just standing in a certain place, but that's Wolfson.
I think Wolfson might be the guy second from the left.
Let's see. Second from right to left. Oh, you're right. Let's see, right to left. So he's next to Herzl. I apologize. Well, I was standing this way. No, just kidding.
Don't worry. For the picture, you know, except for a little hair, we wouldn't know the difference.
Seriously, it's not that good a picture. But I just love the fact that they're all standing there in their tuxedos. I mean, where could they have been going in Palestine in 1898? The British weren't there to impress, you know, so I don't understand it.
Because that's how Europeans dressed.
Right. Well, and I saw this picture in several places. They were formal people. And certainly Herzl was perpetuating an image, and I assume the others went along with him. I saw this picture in several places, but none of them had a description of it. So, unfortunately, I guess that's lost to the history books. Some archivist somewhere knows it. All right, so originally the successor job to Herzl was offered to our old friend Max Nordau. Remember, Max Nordau was with Herzl in the beginning, in the 1890s. Nordau was the famed social commentator of the late 19th century in Europe. Was based in Paris, originally from German-speaking lands. Nordau declined, saying that his wife wasn't Jewish, so he didn't feel it was appropriate. Now, the truth is, he probably couldn't have done the job. He didn't have those types of skills, and he was also really a man of the late 19th century. It was the early 20th century now. Things were changing rapidly. I mean, you think this is a time when technology is going crazy, not dissimilar from today, right? You have airplanes and cars and telephones and, you know, electric streetlights and what have you, and advances in medicine going on. It's a different type of world. It's not the one where you can sit back and pontificate in the way that you could when he was in his height of fame in the 1870s and 1880s. Nordau, by the way, approved of Wolfson. He said that would be a good thing, so there was some continuity going there. Wolfson was 49 years old when he took over. He was an old man in a young man's movement. Many of the newer delegates were increasingly younger. They were in their 20s. They were very truculent in many regards. He was a more cerebral man. He was a little more refined than the others. I'll give you a little background on him. He was born in 1856. Oh, by the way, of course, I forgot to mention, it was a thankless job. Nothing that he could do would have been right. And certainly Herzl felt that, and you read his diary, you see the increasing bitterness as the years go on, because why doesn't everybody listen to me? Why are they doing all this? He was born in 1856. He died in 1914. He died in the job, so unfortunately it's not a good job in some regards. The first two people died in it. He's from Lithuania. He has religious parents. He's raised religious. His father's a rabbi. He goes into the army. Oh, I'm sorry, he doesn't go into the army. In 1872, he's sent to Germany to escape the army. He gets across the border. It wasn't that hard to do in those days. Eventually, he establishes himself in Cologne, Germany. He gets active in the very small Chovevei Tzion group. You might remember the Lovers of Zion group we talked about a while back, Chovevei Tzion. And he starts gaining his wealth as a timber merchant. So he's financially well-to-do, which doesn't hurt when you do this job as well. He's smart, he's devoted, and he has no charisma. In short, he's not Herzl. He's not the visionary. But he's a good guy. And his enemies wouldn't necessarily say that, but he's a good guy. Some of the things that he did do: he tried to keep up Herzl's political contacts. Twice he went to see the Sultan in Turkey, the head of the Ottoman Empire. There were two main reasons that he did this. One is he kept looking for an inn to get that coveted charter from the Sultan so that he could start an official colony settlement in Palestine instead of people just trickling in. And there were several occasions when the Turks actually canceled the right for Jews to emigrate to Palestine. And he went and successfully lobbied the Sultan to have that overturned. So he did do certain things. Then came the Turkish revolutions. The Young Turks revolted in 1908. The Ottoman Empire is not done yet. The Ottoman Empire hangs on until about 1922, actually after World War I. Most people think it died in World War I, but it hung on a little bit longer. And the Zionist movement is ecstatic that there's a revolution in Turkey. It's very hopeful that now, with the Young Turks, as they're called, Kemal Atatürk, that they can get that coveted charter of the nations, because these are people who speak about nationalism, and they say they're going to give more rights to minorities within the Turkish Empire, and so on and so on. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be true. They were interested in nationalism, but they were interested in Turkish nationalism. And these were the people who would go on in 1916 and 1917 to slaughter the Armenians. So we know how they felt about other nationalisms, particularly people like Jamal Pasha, who's going to wind up ruling Syria and Palestine during World War I. Nonetheless, someone such as Herzl, Nordau, said, if Herzl had lived to this day, he would have been overjoyed and said, this is my charter. So the grandfather of the movement, Max Nordau, thought it was going to be a great thing, and that trickled down, but it was to be naught. So the Zionist movement, still in some regards, is not getting anywhere. It's tremendously difficult to raise money. Now, one of the reasons why it's tremendously difficult to raise money is because you have Jews in the United States and Western Europe and England who aren't interested in Zionism, because they're the more assimilated Jews. Now, I'm not going to say they're assimilating out, I'm just going to say they're more, maybe integrated is a better word. Including some of the very wealthy people like Montefiore, whose father was a huge benefactor to Palestine in the earlier years. He did one more thing, Wolfson, that was very successful. He set up the Palestine office of the Zionist organization. And this is where a guy named Arthur Ruppin, R-U-P-P-I-N, comes in. This enabled them to have eyes on the ground and enabled them to have a relationship with Turkish authorities, and it gave the settlers an address. And Ruppin was just the man for the cause. We're going to learn a lot more about him next week, so I don't want to go into too much detail right now, other than to say that his priority was to buy land so the Jews could settle. And indeed, much of the controversies over the Israeli-Arab conflict comes from some of those land purchases. And we've talked about it in the past. You buy land from an absentee landowner who happens to be in Turkey or somewhere else, and you go to the Arabs who have lived on the land for five or six generations, and you say, this is my land, you need to leave now. And they say, what are you talking about? We've always lived here. It creates some dissension, to say the least. The Eastern European Jews, to say the least, are his biggest critics, even though he is of them. Remember, he had come from Lithuania. Nonetheless, this rising faction slash fraction of Chaim Weizmann and others say, you're not the man for the job. You're not interested in Yiddishkeit the way we are. You're just interested in the charter from the nations. He couldn't raise money. He couldn't head a national Jewish organization. Here's one of my favorite quotes of all time. An American Zionist, Louis Lipsky, said of him, he was a man of ordinary education, without ability, without judgment, lacking dynamism, and the capacity for leadership, who did not understand the Herzlian idea of which he professed to be a disciple. Kind of, you know, let us know what you really feel. So that's how he was seen by certain Zionist leaders. It's not fair to say that he was a total bust, however. He was an excellent organizer. He did hard work. It was a near impossible position. He just couldn't be Herzl. It's what I call the Joe Altobelli syndrome. Does anybody remember who Joe Altobelli was?
Manager of the Orioles.
Yeah, he succeeded Earl Weaver.
But he won a World Series.
Huh? He did, and he was fired the next year. Joe, nobody generally remembers. You're one of the rare ones who remember who Joe Altobelli was. He was there for 2.5 seasons. He won a World Series. When you follow God, it's pretty hard to do the job. You know, never, ever take a job where you follow somebody who's been in there for 30 years or whatever and, you know, set the whole mantra of the organization. You know, you're a very special person if you do well at that. It's not a good opportunity for you, to say the least. All right, any questions until now? All right, so we've been talking a little bit about what happened in the Zionist organization after Herzl died. Now we're going to talk about World War I. World War I changes everything for the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement by 1918 is radically different than it was in 1914. In every way. And now the community in Palestine was very different too, and we'll talk about the reasons soon, but it went from about 85,000 to 56,000 because there were expulsions, because people fled, because some people starved to death, there was a famine in the land. Palestine wasn't a good place to be in World War I until December of 1917 when General Allenby came in with the British troops and liberated Jerusalem. He still had, by the way, about another half a year to before they could take the Galilee and the northern part of the country. So that was far from the end of the story. All right. By the eve of World War I, even though things aren't great for the Zionist movement, there are more sympathizers than ever. 127,000 people around the world had actually joined the Zionist movement. To join the Zionist movement, you had to give what's called, what they said was one shekel. One shekel was basically the equivalent of a dollar, whatever your country was. You know, it was a rand if you were from South Africa, it was a kopeck if you were from Russia, and so on and so on. So 127,000 people actually went that far. Hundreds of thousands of others, particularly in Eastern Europe, were sympathizers. It was organized around, there was organizations around the world, as I said, South Africa. The U.S. organization was about to take off when Justice Brandeis gets involved in, or Louis Brandeis, not quite justice yet, in 1915. Russia all over the place, there are various organizations. Still the old Kovetsion ones are the basis of that. England has a small group. Even France, which is considered a very assimilated community, has a small group going on. We talked about Hebrew schools. Zionist literature is now being translated into many languages around the world because the Zionist organization is sending out its literature and then it's being translated by these various groups. There's JNF blue boxes that we saw last time we were here. They're all over the world now. Remember we saw that original first one, which I love taking a look at. The Zionist movement at this point also, or just before this point, started asking itself a serious question. Where do we want to be in the hierarchy of the Jewish community? We're not all moving to Palestine. Israel, the land of Israel. Do we start running candidates in local elections? And indeed, they started running candidates in local elections, whether it was in Russia in 1906, which held an election after the 1905 revolution, mini-revolution, I guess, and in Poland, and several Zionist political candidates began winning parliament seats, particularly in Poland. And this was an interesting question for them to face. They became part and part of the Jewish community. It wasn't just something that was going for one goal and then it was going to go out of business. There was a sense of permanence for the people who were involved in the organizations. All right, let me give you some stats about the Jewish community in the land of Israel in the eve of World War I in 1914. So I mentioned there were 85,000 in the Yishuv. Everybody remembers what the Yishuv is, right? The community, the settlement. And today on the West Bank, settlements are called Yishuvim. They were 12% of the country, which had 700,000 people total. Now, they were only 4% of the country, 5% of the country in 1880.
When you say country, exactly how are you defining the geographic borders?
The land that Israel controls today, which means the land west of the Jordan River, going up into the Galilee, not the Golan Heights.
But including the West Bank.
Including the West Bank. Because there was no such thing as the West Bank at that point. Right. That comes after 67. Actually, I'm sorry, that comes after, I have to check to see if they used that terminology in 48, 49, after the war. I'm not sure. I don't know if the Jordanians used that terminology or not. Certainly it's the west bank of the river, but it's a very arbitrary line, an armistice line. More than half of the community lived in Jerusalem. But guess what? Let's not forget, most of them were Orthodox Jews. Right? We still have a primarily Orthodox community there, and in Tiberias, and in Sfat. About half the Jews in the country are Orthodox Jews. Now, in 1880, all the Jews in the country were Orthodox Jews. So this is a big difference, and there were roughly 45,000. At that point, there's roughly 85,000 at this point. Nobody can give you an absolutely exact answer because the Turks didn't have a census. But you can kind of figure out from immigration records, and that's what historians have primarily done. 10 to 15,000 lived in Jaffa and the new city of Tel Aviv. The city of Tel Aviv started in 1909. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the Second Aliyah, which is in 2 weeks. It was a bedroom community to Jaffa. It was seen as a suburb of Jaffa. And it wasn't too many years ago, ironically, that Tel Aviv swallowed up Jaffa, and the official name of the city now is, when you look on the maps, is Tel Aviv Jaffa, or Tel Aviv Jaffo. About 12,000 lived in 45 agricultural settlements. So about 45 agricultural settlements around the country. Those were all the secular Jews. They had farms to train women in animal husbandry. There was something called the Palestine National Bank, where you could get a loan. There were collectives of vegetable growers. There were plant nurseries. There was an infrastructure that clearly was being put into plan here. Yeah?
So the young, I guess, Eastern European Jews who were in the settlement, the Jews, they were raised Orthodox?
Most of them were raised Orthodox. And they became the modern...
Their families were Orthodox, their parents?
Right. They became the modern equivalent of the Maskilim. They just weren't interested in it anymore. It didn't meet their needs. The world was a bigger place. They wanted to take full part in the world as a Jew, but just not as a religious Jew.
But they were somewhat educated. I mean, I know they were young, but they were somewhat educated as Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, Chaim Weizmann was in a cheder until he was 12, a traditional school, and then he went to a high school. Which was a secular high school. But that's the world they came from. You know, we all think of our bubbies and how she did certain things on the holidays and certain foods, even more so for them. The difference, of course, for them is when they were walked away from their homes, they couldn't go back. Right? There was just nothing for them there anymore. That's why they flocked into the universities in Western Europe. If you went to Germany or Switzerland in those days in particular, they were loaded with Eastern European Jews who just happened to be fluent in German. And Yiddish, and Russian, and maybe something else. They were very bright people. These were the cream of the crop, you know, without question. And we see that with Weizmann and the people that he collected around him. So, as we've been saying, the community was split between these secularized, I don't want to say secular, because that's kind of a weird word. They were secularized Jews and religious Jews. And when I say religious Jews, it's not the modern Orthodox type, right? It's the black hat, you know, old-style yeshiva type. These secularists, by the way, were revolutionaries, literally. Some of them, like David Ben-Gurion, fled Russia after the 1905 revolution. And Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, who would be the second president of Israel, was one of his buddies. They came with many ideas. They were serious ideologues. They did a lot of reading of revolutionary tactics. They talked about strikes and workers' rights. And we have some of the readings in our Penzker book about that. You start having tensions with the religious Jews in Palestine. You have things called mixed dances going on. Men and women dressed not necessarily, quote-unquote, appropriately. So you can't say there's a united Jewish community. You can't say that today in Israel. So why could you be able to say it then? You start having theater performances. There's a prohibition in Orthodox Judaism, depending on how you interpret it, against hearing the voice of a woman in public. There's all types of ways that it can be interpreted that authorities have done, but it was a problem for the religious. At the same time, Hebrew is a daily language. You have newspapers that are publishing in Hebrew. You have people, kids who are being born and raised just speaking Hebrew. Something different is taking place here. And everyone had a crazy story. You know, I once heard a speaker who said, that every one of the founding fathers of Israel was nuts. Everyone was crazy. They were running from this, they were running from that, they fought with this, they fought with that. Now, Shai Egnon, who was a great writer and would go on to win Israel's first Nobel Prize in 1964, had this to say about the people who came in those years. Rabinovich has nothing to do with his creator and nothing against his creator. Ever since the day Rabinovich left his hometown, it's doubtful that he remembered him. Many are the issues a person has to deal with, and he hasn't got time to remember everything. So these were people who were on the run, not necessarily because they were draft dodgers, but because they were running away from and perhaps to something as well. All right. When the war started, the situation for the Jews degenerated rather quickly. And the Zionist movement itself was split, just like the nations of the war was split. The Ottomans saw the Russian Jews, Jews from the Russian-speaking lands, as enemy agents, provocateurs. They began moving to export them. They export as many as, I think it was, so I thought it was 16,000. They eventually deported 18,000, including people like David Ben-Gurion, who spent much of the war in New York City, where he would meet a woman named Paula and get married, and learn English as well, and certainly learn a lot about the American Jewish community. And he has some neat things to say about that in his own books. All these folks who went on to leadership positions, by the way, they all wrote books. They all wrote memoirs. It's just a totally, you know, I don't know if we could do that today, because we'd have to save all our emails, and then we'd have to figure out a way to make a thread for a story of that. These guys sat down, and I was looking online today at Chaim Weizmann, his virtual tour of his house in Rehovot, and his desk, and the letters, and the books. And, you know, these guys actually sat down, took the time, communicated with people. It was a different era. They're very, very thoughtful people. And when you read Weizmann's book, he quotes from letters he wrote to people over the years, which says, hey, he saved all those letters. You remember, some of you have seen it. They used to write on papers that would, I can't remember what it's called, carbon copy. And the carbon paper was underneath it, and they would save that. I don't even know if they used typewriters. I think they were all handwritten. I couldn't read any of my stuff. I don't know how they did. All right. The community in Palestine would have been in even worse shape if, believe it or not, the German government didn't come to its rescue. Remember, the Germans and the Ottomans were allied during World War I. The Germans bought into the power of Jewish influence, as did most other governments, including the British government, is one of the reasons why it signed the Balfour Declaration. The German government, giving in to the concern and inquiries of its own Jewish community and hoping to stir some affinity with the Russian Jewish community so that it would revolt against the Tsar, because the Russians were fighting the Germans, intervened with the Turks and said, on several occasions, and said, you know, don't expel them, don't hurt them, let them be. One of the great tragic ironies of the world is a couple decades later, it'll be a very different story. Some Jewish men were drafted into the Ottoman army because some of these folks, when they came there, said, we need to prove our loyalty to the Turks, we need to get Turkish citizenship. So they got Turkish citizenship, so guess what happens in wartime? You go serve in the army. Tel Aviv was evacuated at one point. A guy named Jamal Pasha, J-E-M-A-L, Pasha is the honorific title, was one of the three rulers of Turkey during World War I, and Jamal Pasha ruled Syria and Palestine, and he really didn't like Jews. So he was slowly making the move to make life as miserable as possible for them, and one of the things they did is said, you need to evacuate Tel Aviv. I've done some research, and I can't find why he wanted to evacuate Tel Aviv. But basically, 6,000 people were forced to leave their homes, which shows you, by the way, Tel Aviv had grown relatively quickly. Right? This was in 1916, so it was only 7 years in. They were taken in by the various kibbutzim and communities. Some of the farming communities, places like Rehovot, had grown to, or Petah Tikva had grown to 3,000 people. Right? It started as a little farm. Now it was a town, and they had taken them in during the war. Some people snuck across the border to Egypt and wound up the war in Cairo. We'd mentioned the community fell from 85,000 to about 55,000 during the war. The export market shrunk because the world was at war. Half your marketplaces were closed off. So those famous Jaffa oranges, which actually really were of importance to the economy at that point, weren't really going anywhere. There was a locust infestation that destroyed the crops. I was reading a thing this afternoon where kids, after school, were sent out with sticks to beat locusts off the crops. They made a game of it. They ran up and down, and they were beating it off the crops. Because the locust came, and because the crops weren't able to come to fruition, there was a famine for many people. You know, things were really bad. There was some relief that would come periodically from the American Jewish community. This is when it first started getting involved in Palestine. They had raised funds through the American Joint Jewish Distribution Committee to send ships of goods over, because remember, America didn't enter the war until 1917. So the Turks would still allow that in. The Turks wouldn't allow anything to come from Britain or France or Russia. Well, not that Russia was going to send anything anyway. By 1917, news had spread about the Armenian massacres. And the Jews of the Yishuv were bona fide worried that they were going to be massacred. They were really scared about this because, and Jamal Pasha was the guy who had overseen the Armenian massacres, and now here he was running Palestine and Syria. So they were quite concerned. Meanwhile, the Zionist movement is split over the war, right? You have good, loyal German Jewish citizens who are Zionists, and the same thing in England, and the same thing in France, and the same thing in Russia. And one of the interesting things, of course, is that in the beginning of the war, the Jews didn't quite know what to do, because should they be on the side of France and Great Britain, who was allied with Russia? Russia? You know what they did to us? That was what the thinking was. Some Jews were part and parcel partisans for the Germans. They wanted the Germans to win in World War I. And remember, World War I was all wars are difficult. This was a particularly difficult war. You really didn't know until early 1918, mid-1918, as to who was going to potentially win that war. Right? In 1917, the Russians had backed out. Right? The Germans had humiliated them at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And they were focusing entirely on the Western Front. If the Germans didn't run out of man reserves, in terms of soldiers, population-wise, they might have won that war. It's entirely possible. And the Zionists didn't know what to do. Now, the Zionist organization had a strict policy of neutrality during the war, which was smart and the only thing to do, because you couldn't jeopardize what you were going to do in different countries. The rub was the Turks controlled Palestine, and guys like Chaim Weizmann in England weren't listening to that. Right? They were partisan loyalists to the nth degree, and you had them in Germany too, truth be told. But officially, the Zionist movement was neutral. And to show that it was neutral, it moved its headquarters from Berlin to Copenhagen, because Copenhagen wasn't in the war. Now, the office in Copenhagen could do virtually nothing during the war. You couldn't have a meeting of the Small Actions Committee, let alone the Greater Actions Committee, because people couldn't cross the lines. Everybody was concerned not with what was happening in Palestine, but with the war. And the only issue with Palestine was, how do we get food and pharmaceuticals in there to save these people's lives, because the whole thing could be gone if we don't hurry up as quickly as we can. Let me see if I think we might. No, still have time. I never quite get the timing. All right. So as an international movement, Zionism is paralyzed during the war. Everybody's a freelancer. And that's why Chaim Weizmann is eventually going to wind up getting the Balfour Declaration. There was talk about moving the office to the United States of America, and Brandeis wanted that, but it just didn't happen. They just weren't able to agree on anything, and they felt that in Copenhagen, at least we could be closer to Palestine and closer to the principles of the movement anyway. But everyone also recognized that the war really could bring a difference for the Zionist movement by the war's end. No matter who won, the Zionist movement could be in a better position. And indeed, there started to be talk from all sides again, buying into, I believe, that Jewish stereotype of power in the world, that they're going to say something good to the Zionists. They're going to issue that famous charter. It didn't come from anyone other than the British, however. Wilson, by the way, remember, is making self-determination a key, because the Ottoman Empire is rife with minorities. So he's trying to rile up the minorities in the Ottoman Empire to revolt, to take some pressure off the Eastern Front for the Allies. All right. World War I also saw a really momentous occasion for not just the Zionist movement, but for the Jewish people. And a lot of people don't know about this and don't give much credit to it, but I think it's one of the more important, psychologically more important elements of modern Zionism. Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor are two names that are legendary in the modern Zionist movement. They began lobbying the British, again, denying the fact that they were supposed to be neutral, for a Jewish army that would fight the Turks. They wanted to go liberate Palestine. Remember, the British controlled England. Britain said no. We don't want foreign nationals, which you guys are, participating in our army. You're not British citizens. You're not going to fight in our army. However, we have a job for you. We want you to create what's called a mule corps. In war in those days, supplies were brought back and forth to the front lines by mules, hundreds and hundreds of mules. Indeed, you read about mules being killed in battle and everywhere. I've done a ton of reading on World War I lately, and mules keep coming up. So these guys formed what's known as the Zion Mule Corps, and they had an insignia with a Jewish star, and they were under the British Army. They weren't technically part of the British Army, but they were under the British Army. Jabotinsky, by the way, rejected the idea, and he left to go lobby others, the Americans and others, to set up a Jewish legion to go fight against the Central Powers. Trumpeldor accepted it, and he went to Egypt, and he began recruiting Jews who had fled from Palestine for this. He got about 650 people to sign up for this. So finally, in on April 25th, 1915, they went into battle. There were 562 of them. They landed with Brits, the Australians, and the New Zealands in the battle on the Gallipoli Peninsula, which was a particularly brutal battle that went on for about a year. Six of them were killed, 25 were wounded, three received military honors, and one received a Distinguished Conduct of Medal. That was on April 25th, 1915. This was the first all-Jewish unit to go into battle since 135 CE. Way back when we started this course, we talked about the Bar Kokhba Rebellion from 132 to 135 BCE. Then we went through the Middle Ages and the 19th century and Napoleon and nationalism and all that. It's been 1,800 some years since an all-Jewish unit has participated in a war. Now, in a world at war, this electrified Jewish communities all over the place. News of this got out. They did well. They handled themselves well under fire with grace. And this was, I think, a very psychologically important moment. And indeed, some of these folks, after the war, went back to Palestine, and they would go on to help found things such as the Haganah, the defense group, which would become the Israel Defense Forces. So this is really when it all started. Finally, by the way, in August 1917, the British relented and said, okay, you can recruit for an all-Jewish battalion. And thus, something called the Jewish Legion was formed. And it would stick around until 1922. They were with the 38th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers. A fusilier is just an old word for a soldier. It means different things at different times. They were from the Zion Mule Corps veterans, British Jews, Russian Jews, and even some American Jews. And at one point, they had about 5,000 Jewish soldiers in there. And let me show you a couple pictures of them. And there's some lovely books written on these folks.
There's one or two guys from Baltimore.
I don't know of them, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I think they had one that was in inducted into the Baltimore Jewish Hall of Fame?
He was.
At the JCC?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the I think the museum had a thing about them.
Neat.
I don't know, he was in the Jewish Legion.
Neat. Well, here are some of them as well. The Western Wall. Remember, it had been freed by the British in 1917. This photo is probably 1918. I found the dates for it and a couple different dates for it, but one person said it's probably 1918, though we can't know for sure. Here's one of my favorite pictures. This is Yom Kippur Services in Nova Scotia in 1918. You know, again, this is really quite a historic thing. First time since 135 CE that Jews are taking up arms to defend the land of Israel. And, all right, there's I actually found some photo albums online from photos and photos and photos. There's a lot of neat stuff out there on these guys.
Did any of the Arab population existing in Palestine at that time fight in the war?
No. The Arab population in Palestine is always interesting this time. They pretty much do nothing, yet there's an Arab army which is liberating Saudi Arabia, what do they call it? The
Hijaz,
that's it. Yeah. Hijaz, right?
Hijaz.
Yeah, the Hijaz.
And it's like a mountain range.
It's the southwestern part
Of Saudi
Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
But the Arabs in Palestine don't take part in that. And they're very pro Ottomans. You know, they are not talking about independence at this point. And that's one of the things we're going to start talking a little bit about tonight is where the Arab nationalism in Palestine begins, because it starts creeping in by the end of World War I. But they're not doing much of anything.
For a little World War I history at you.
Sure.
You know, the British were coming from Egypt, and they were trying to capture Palestine, and they fought in Gaza, and they were stalemated. So they swung around to the right, and they attacked Beersheba.
Correct.
That's where they broke the lines.
And they actually laid a whole pipe from Gaza to Beersheba for water for their camps.
So that was the last successful military or cavalry charge in the annals of military history. Was the capture of Beersheba by the Australian light horsemen. And if you're from Australia, especially Perth, Australia, then you're very familiar with Beersheba.
Wow. Yeah, I think they call it the Anzac Brigades.
Yeah, the Anzac were the soldiers.
Right.
It was like October 31st of 1917 was the battle. And they have reenactments there. There's actually a...
Wow.
I lived in Beersheba. Mm-hmm. And right next to my school was a British cemetery, and all the soldiers were Australian. And in fact, there are a couple of Jewish soldiers in that cemetery.
Yeah, these wars were just... when you read the number of people who were killed, I mean, I mentioned the Battle of Gallipoli over the course of a year that the first Zion Mule Corps was in. I think something like 700,000 were killed. I mean, 700,000.
And that was a total disaster for the British,
Yeah.
That was Churchill.
For Churchill.
Yeah, but didn't stop him, you know?
Well, he had a falling out, but then he came back,
right.
I guess.
Yeah, he fell out and wrote a few more books.
Right.
All right. Where were we? Okay, so... the Jewish Legion, as it's called, is headed by Jabotinsky. Trumpeldor is back. When Jerusalem and southern Palestine is taken by Allenby, they're allowed to come up. They weren't allowed to participate in that battle, but they did serve in the Jordan Valley battle. 20 were wounded, killed, or captured. They fought the Ottomans in northern Israel, and they fought in what was known as the Battle of Megiddo, which liberated the rest of the country in mid-September of 1918. After the war, they were reduced from 5 divisions to 1. Now, it's obvious why Jews wanted to serve in this battalion, right? Because they wanted to liberate Palestine. But what did it do for them? What else did it do? Any thoughts?
Change the image.
Change the image, certainly.
Train them.
Train them, exactly. It gave them experience in a quality army. And that's exactly what they needed and wanted. And we've seen that in the past as well. All right, their legacy. Former members, after it was decommissioned in 1922, formed defense groups throughout the country. And they were part and parcel, as I said, of the groups that started the Haganah, the Defense Corps. The British didn't want a Jewish Legion to be around after 1922 for other obvious reasons. They didn't want to be seen as favoring the Jews over the Arabs. That there's going to be constant tension on that, which we're going to spend the next few weeks on. Their former members actually went to a moshav called Avichavil, and there's now a museum there in the Legion's memory. And I was looking for some information. I found one really nice film on it, but unfortunately it's no sound to it, so they don't narrate. They just go through the cases, so I didn't think you'd want to be bored with that.
What's the name of the kibbutz?
A-V-I. Let me double check. H-A-V-I-L. It's a moshav, not a kibbutz. All right, let's take about a couple-minute break now. That's a good point to stop.
And it's the story of the character.
Get started again. There's one more chapter in World War I that I want to talk about, and it's about a group called Neely. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of that.
I have.
What do you know about it?
They were some Jews who spied on the Turks. Several of them were captured.
Almost all of them were captured. Yeah.
Neely is an acronym for me. It's like the creator is the only one who I recognize or something like that.
Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. The eternal of Israel shall not lie.
Okay. And
from Samuel.
It's a very popular women's name.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too. N-I-L-I. It's an abbreviation for the Hebrew.
The national chairman of the Friends of the IDF, her name is Neely. So that's why I had to check it out. I said, where did you come up with that name? That's why I know that.
All right, so it's, again, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, the eternal one of Israel shall not lie. So God will never deceive you. It really centers around a guy named Aaron Aronson. This is a likely name, right? Aaron Aronson. He was a famed agronomist in his day. Excuse me. He had discovered something called the mother of wheat strain. There was a problem with growing wheat at that time in terms of certain parasites that would kill the plant, and he was able to discover a parasite-resistant strain, which was called the mother of wheat by, I don't really understand it, by tracing it back to the original wheat strain, or so it said. But that's for stuff for people that know much more than I do. He also worked on crops, making them more resistant to locust attacks. As we mentioned, during World War I, locusts came through the area periodically. And we have cicadas, but that's nothing like locusts. Fortunately, we don't have locusts around here. At least, I don't think we have locusts around here. In 1910... the Americans actually helped fund a agronomist station for him at Atlit, A-T-L-I-T, which is still operating. Buildings changed a little bit since then.
That's where the Israeli paratroopers are?
I don't know that. It's possible there's a base by there.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's by Atlit is a town in Israel. There's a great fish restaurant if you ever want to go there, right off the highway.
Where is it?
Isn't it where the camp was?
It's just south of Haifa.
Isn't that where the camp was in the Second World War?
What camp?
Atlit.
I think the paratrooper brigade is
okay.
In the book, I think they were training right south of Haifa.
Probably Atlit. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not familiar with the name of the base or what, David? You were saying?
I was thinking Atlit was a camp that the Israelis set up or the Brits set up to when they would catch people trying to smuggle into the country, and one night they were all. The Haganah broke them all out.
Right, the Aliyah Bet, the illegal immigration. I'm not sure if that's the name of the camp, but it's entirely possible. I wouldn't be surprised because a lot of ships came in by Haifa because of the bay, because of Haifa Bay and the port there.
Beg you remember that from something.
Yeah. Yeah?
No.
Oh, you look like you look like you're at
it. I'm agreeing. Because sometimes those camps have uses, depending upon who's kind of in charge, that they're repeatedly used for different practices.
We've got a camp.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Put somebody in.
Correct.
Well, certainly the Jews took over all the British installations very quickly.
Those that they didn't give to the Canadians.
Yeah. They're the ones the Brits didn't destroy. His family were early settlers of a town called Zichron Yaakov that some of you might have been to. Zichron Yaakov was one of the...
That's the Rothschild.
Right. The Baron Rothschild, exactly. There's a winery there. You can go take a tour and taste wine at the end now. It's quite enjoyable, although I recommend you shouldn't do it earlier than 1 in the afternoon. I say that from experience. He was educated in one of the barons.
Yeah, what are we talking about
again? Zichron Yaakov.
Get that down.
Yeah.
It's near, also near an army base, isn't it?
Yes, yes. That's I was at Volunteers for Israel in the army base next door to that. Basis Rifin. All right. He decided that during the war that the fate of the Yishuv would be much better off with the democracies of the world than with the vagaries and the unpredictable realities of the Turks. So he decided he was going to start spying for the British. And what he and others whom he recruited, including many of his family members, would do is they would travel around the country because they were agronomists, and they would have their notepads, and they would be able to write down where various installations were, how many troops were there, when the troops were moving. And every 2 weeks off the course, first he had to go sneak out of the country on a, no, he didn't sneak out of the country. He went based on a, he said it was a mission to find out more from some universities in Europe. He made contact with the British, he got over to London, and he said, I want to spy for you guys. You know, the war had already been going on. And they said, no, we don't trust you, but finally he convinced them. So he came back. And then he, every 2 weeks, they would transmit from a transmitter that they had smuggled into the country to a British ship that had come up from Cairo off the coast of Haifa, various information. He made his way back to Cairo. He wound up the rest of the war in Cairo. Excuse me. It wasn't safe after a while for the British ship to continue going, so they decided to use homing pigeons. And they, in the home, I'm fascinated by homing pigeons, by the way. I don't know how they train them. I don't know how they get them to go where they were supposed to go. But one of them didn't go where it was supposed to go. In fact, I think it landed in the head of the city of Akko during the war. It landed on his sill, and this person grabbed it. And they took some time, and they deciphered a message, which was a mixture of Hebrew, English, French, and Aramaic. That's the code that they used. And they figured out what was going on, and they went and they arrested all these people who were involved with Neeley. And it was particularly brutal. Some of them were taken to Damascus, where they were eventually hanged. Some of them were given 1 to 3 years of service. Aaron Aronson's sister actually was being tortured, and she wound up grabbing the pistol off the soldier who was torturing her and killing herself. These people did not, she did not want to know what fate awaited her in a Turkish jail or a Syrian jail as well. Nonetheless, this was invaluable information to General Allenby, the commander of the British troops, who was based in Cairo, as he was planning his spring campaign into Palestine. This was 1917. The British had waited a long time to open this front since they had their failed campaign in 1916 in Gallipoli to get under the Turks' soft underbelly. They were going to try and get them this way. The leadership of the Yishuv, by the way, denied all knowledge of this, and there was a good reason for it. That Aaron Aronson and his compatriots purposely didn't tell them about it. They wanted there to be plausible deniability. They didn't want the Yishuv to get in trouble if anything went awry. But things, as we already recall, were still pretty bad for people in the Yishuv at this time, and they were afraid that Jamal Pasha was going to begin a massacre of people, or he was trying to do that, were it not for the intervention of the Germans and several others. Aronson, by the way, remained alive, and through the end of the war, and by 1920, he was one of Chaim Weizmann's great confidants, and he was killed in a plane crash crossing the channel from France to England. Some people say that the plane was sabotaged because he knew too much about what the British had done during the war, and he knew too much about British troops and what have you. Those are conspiracy theories. You can choose to buy into them or not. But that's one of the things that people say. There's a museum now in Zichron Yaakov to Neeley. It's at the old Aronson family home. And I know that on my next trip to Israel, I actually really want to go there. I've never been there. I didn't know that they had a museum. One of the neat things about Israel is when you go around the country is you discover there's a neat little museum in every corner. Or something significant, like Jill, you were telling me about the hotel that you stayed in. There's everything has a story, particularly if it's not steel and chrome and glass, then it's got a story. If there's some stone in it, it's got a story. All right. Now we're going to get to the competing, overlapping, contradicting, and maddening promises that the British made to Arabs and Jews starting in this period. All for different reasons, but this, in some regards, is why the Middle East remains a colossal mess today. Has to do with realpolitik. By the way, I had a film to show you of Allenby entering Jerusalem in 1917, but it didn't show up on this browser, so I encourage you to go on YouTube and type... That didn't work. Don't look at me puzzled, it didn't work. I encourage you to go on YouTube and type Allenby, Jerusalem, General Allenby. First thing that happens is the Sykes-Picot Agreement. All right, the Sykes-Picot Agreement is a secret pact between the French and the British with the agreement of Russia. And what they say is, and this is roughly in, it was signed secret in March 1916. They're going to divide the Middle East. We're going to win the war, they say, even though they don't know that, of course. But when we do, we're going to divide the spoils of the Turks. The Russians are going to get what's contiguous to their border. The French are going to have controlling influence here and out-and-out take this area. The British are going to have out-and-out take this area here, see Baghdad coming through Kuwait. And they're going to have controlling influence here. Palestine, or most of Palestine, or half of Palestine, the part that we're generally concerned with, Jerusalem, Haifa, is going to be internationalized. The international community is going to have a say in what it's going to be. Now, the Brits were trying to do something important here. They were trying to protect the Suez Canal, because the Suez Canal was their way to Egypt. The sun never sets on the British Empire, but it's going to set more quickly if we can't get our troops and ships through here pretty quickly. So they're thinking globally.
India.
What did I say? Egypt. I'm sorry. India. Yes, absolutely India. This was a secret pact. They didn't want the Americans to know about it. They didn't want other people, the Germans, to know about it. They certainly didn't want the Turks to know about it. It comes to light after the 1917 revolution, the second revolution, the communist one, in the fall, in Russia. Because the communists, to, you know, cast dispersions on the British and the French, decided to publish all of the Tsar's secret pacts.
The Snowden affair of the time.
Yes. Well, somewhat. What this did is it upset the Arabs, who had been told by what we're about to cover, the Hussein McMahon correspondence, that they were going to get all this material, even though Palestine might go to the Jews. They were going to get all this in self-rule, and the French were going to get what's called the Lebanon, or Mount Lebanon, in the area surrounding Mount Lebanon. So that's the first thing to know, is that the British and the French secretly divided the area and irritated the Arabs. Yeah?
What's that little pink spot up by Syria?
That's another international area. It's a warm water port. I'm not sure. I can't...
It's got to be the Russians. You're always looking for a warm water port.
Let's see.
Is that
Aleppo? Well,
Aleppo is right here.
It
says Alexandretta, which I'm not familiar with.
Is that where the Alawites are?
The Russians use now.
You know, I don't know the ethnic map of Syria that well, so I don't want to say one way or another.
The Alawites are the tribe of...
No, I know who they are. They're 11% of the country.
Right.
Yeah.
And I know they're located in northwest Syria.
Okay. But that looks like, you know, I can't tell. It's just outside of Syria, too. It's in Turkey. Alexandretta. Okay. So, the Arabs are upset. The British and French are embarrassed. That's because this contradicts the Hussein McMahon correspondence. The Hussein McMahon correspondence... Let's see if I have something. Hussein McMahon correspondence goes like this. There is an exchange of letters in 1915 and 1916 between the British High Commissioner of Egypt, Henry McMahon, and Sharif Hussein. Sharif Hussein, actually let me go back to the map, is located in, as we said earlier, the Hejaz, which is a region of Saudi Arabia, which is right around, let's see, right around here. And it comes down a little farther as well.
With Mecca being...
Mecca and Medina are within it.
Right.
The two holy cities.
And the Turks had a rail line.
That is correct.
Damascus.
You watched the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
And read the book, too.
Which book?
I think The Pillars. No, that's the book that he wrote. A recent one.
Oh, Lawrence?
He
wrote a book.
Pillars of Fire or something like that.
I'm not sure.
It wasn't his. It was a biography.
Neat. Interesting character, to say the least. The Sharif was promised an independent state. As I said, it was going to be all of Saudi Arabia, not Baghdad, this area here. This was going to be British, but he was going to get all of this. Eventually, at that point, he was going to get Palestine too, and he was going to get all of Syria. He thought he was going to get Mount Lebanon, but he said it was okay if I don't get Mount Lebanon. I know the French have an interest there. The French interest there is that the Maronite Christians are there, and they believe that they are the protectors of the Maronite Christians. This is something that goes back to the earlier in the 19th century when they declared that was part and parcel of their foreign policy. So, in exchange for that, the Arabs under Faisal, who was one of Sharif Hussein's sons, created an army, and they started the revolt, known as the Arab Revolt, against the Turks. And they blew up the railway, and they surrounded Turkish garrisons, and they won the peninsula for the British. So things were looking pretty good. This is where we said Lawrence of Arabia comes in. This also cleared the way for General Allenby's march into Jerusalem, because it began battering some of the troops of the Turkish Empire. Furthermore, during the war, thousands of leaflets were dropped into Palestine by the British. One side was a message from Sharif Hussein, basically saying, "My brothers, we're here we're coming to liberate you. Don't worry, the day of independence is at hand." The other side was from the British command, and it said that, quote, "An Anglo-Arab agreement securing the independence of Arabs is coming." The Arabs were primed for an independent state. The Arabs believed that the British were going to have some influence in that state, but that they would rule the state. And Sharif Hussein was really the only pan-Arab leader at the time. Indeed, the Arab world today is struck by the lack of a pan-Arab leader, and various leaders have tried to make themselves that. Saddam Hussein was one of them, right? He thought he was the liberator of the entire Arab world. How you liberate countries by invading them is a whole other story. So Allenby is on the move in the Sinai. At this point, Allenby, as we were talking before, takes Gaza first. Well, first he takes the Sinai Desert, then he takes Gaza, then he takes Beersheba, and he's poised to come take Jerusalem. And let's see, where did he go? Yeah, thank you. Here he is. He finally takes Jerusalem on December 6, 1917. He famously gets off his horse and walks through the Jaffa Gate, so he's not seen as a conqueror, but just as a regular person. But indeed he was a conqueror, and indeed the Arabs saw this as perhaps the beginning of a new crusade. Here was the white Christian man coming back for the first time since 1000-something or 1100-something. Actually, a crusader kingdom survived a couple hundred years around Akko, but many centuries. Has come, and he's going to rule over us, even though we have all these pacts going on. So for the Arabs, it's the feeling of a start of a new crusade.
Are you just talking about in Palestine or the whole region?
Right now, they just have Egypt and they have Palestine. They don't have Syria yet, or Jordan, but they're going to get that soon. Here, by the way, I thought you'd love this. This is British artillery on Mount Scopus, the home of today's Hebrew University. Looks a little different today, say the least. So Allenby confuses things a little more. He says the Allies were in honor bound to endeavor to reach a settlement in accordance with the wishes of the peoples concerned, and urged him to place his trust wholeheartedly in their good faith. That's Allenby to Faisal. Then comes the Anglo-French Declaration. The Arab hopes are rising. Jewish hopes are rising at the same time, which we'll get to soon with the Balfour Declaration. The Anglo-French Declaration of 1918 The object aimed at by France and the United Kingdom in prosecuting in the East the war let loose by the ambition of Germany is the complete and definite emancipation of the peoples so long oppressed by the Turks, and the establishment of national governments and administrations deriving their authority from the initiative and free choice of the indigenous populations. Zionists aren't going to like that, say the least. All right, this is just, a peace talks come, and just to let you see this, it's an interesting historical note. The peace talks go from 1919 through 1920. This is what the Zionists asked for at the peace talks. Would have been a very different story had that been granted. Right, so on both sides of the Jordan River and up to the Litani River in Lebanon, they wanted to capture the sources of the water that was flowing into Israel. So they're a little farther north in Israel, too. They're taking the Golan Heights as well. Meanwhile, at those Paris peace talks, this ostensibly gets ratified or approved. It doesn't get fully ratified until something called the San Remo Conference. The League of Nations, which is set up, sets up mandates, because what it says to the Arabs and to the Jews, but more to the Arabs, is you might be independent one day, but you're not there yet. We can't give it to you yet. We're going to put this online if you want to get it tomorrow, Stephanie. So, and I can always get you different maps and all that. Syria is going to be French. Lebanon, Iraq is British. Arabia is left alone for right now because there's nothing of interest to anyone there, but the British still have sway over it, and Palestine. Egypt still is under British control as well. What we have to do now is talk about the Balfour Declaration, because the Balfour Declaration contradicts all of this. And what the British have done is tried to make everybody happy. And that might have worked the moment they published their document, but it didn't work when they tried to apply it. To do that, we're going to talk about Chaim Weizmann. Let me see, and I'm going to flip through Weizmann a little bit so I can get to the Balfour Declaration, which is part of Weizmann. I'm going to give you a couple of biographical pieces of Weizmann. Weizmann was another in the remarkable line of Zionist leaders. And Weizmann was truly the heir to Herzl in that he was a strong leader for the Zionist movement. If you think about it, from 1897 to 1952, the Zionist movement really only had two strong leaders. Well, actually, I should say David Ben-Gurion as well. So it's had three strong leaders. Weizmann was born in 1874 and died, as he said, in 1952. He was born in a small town, Motul, which is Belarus, which is part of Russia today. He was the third of 15 children. His father was a timber merchant until he was 11. That's a lot of kids, right?
They were busy.
Yeah, until 11, he was in Cheder. Then he went to a high school in Pinsk. But it wasn't enough for him. He wanted to study chemistry, so he made his way to Western Europe. First he made his way to Germany, then to Switzerland. He received a PhD with honors. By 1904, he was invited to become a senior lecturer in chemistry at the University of Manchester in England. He quickly became a Zionist leader. And we've talked about his attendance at various Zionist conferences and his work in the fraction of people who wanted more cultural Zionism and education to take place. By 1904, he had established himself so quickly that he was already meeting with members of Parliament, and he met with a man named Lord Balfour. Lord Balfour was his member of Parliament at that time. And they were talking about the need for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Now, there's Chaim Weizmann. It's nice. So this is from Weizmann's book over here that I have. Balfour said, "Why so much do you want Palestine?" And Weizmann said, "Mr. Balfour, supposing I was to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it?" He sat up, looked at me, and answered, "But Dr. Weizmann, we have London." "That's true," I said, "but we've had Jerusalem when London was a marsh." He said two things which I remember vividly. The first was, "Are there many Jews who think like you?" I answered, "I believe I speak the mind of millions of Jews whom you will never see and who cannot speak for themselves." To this he said, "If that is so, you will one day be a force." Now, if Weizmann doesn't say so himself. He wrote this after Balfour died, so we don't know how true it is. Sometimes these guys make stuff up, but there's probably a similar type of statement. This, by the way, I'm going to talk about the Balfour Declaration, but this was as it was published in the London Times. Whoops. Which I thought was kind of neat to take a look at. Palestine for the Jews, official sympathy. Couldn't get away with writing a headline like that today. All right, the crowning moment in his... Why was he famous and in a position of influence to start with? Weizmann invented synthetic acetone. Acetone is something that's needed to stop a telltale sign of smoke from an artillery piece after it's fired. In battle, this is a very important thing. He developed this through a certain fermentation process of bacteria, and he was able to mass produce it quite substantially, and it was seen as very significant to the British war effort in World War I. He became wealthy from it, he gained a lot of contacts from it, and he was in a position to really become a player in society, and he chose to do that in Jewish society and with the Zionists as well. And by the way, he fought with the established British community all along. Montefiore, Montagu, people like this, they did not want there to be a Jewish state because they felt that Judaism was a religion. It's kind of the classical reform thing that we talked about. This was very real, and the official part of the community was against them. However, increasingly, the rank and file of the community was with Weizmann. So he was a very controversial figure in his day. Why was Weizmann in a position to get the Balfour Declaration? Since 1904, he's been meeting with the British Parliament members. He's getting to know people. This is 1917 already, really 1916 when he starts. He kept his ties with Balfour. Balfour in 1916 becomes foreign minister. The government falls and Lloyd George becomes prime minister. He pulls Balfour up with him. Finally, on November 2nd, 1917, this Balfour Declaration was released. It was the result of many months of back and forth with the British government. The Zionist organization, or Weizmann, would give the government a proposed text. The government would say, no, we don't like this, and they take it back, and they keep going back and forth and back and forth. And keep in mind, all along, Weizmann is ignoring the neutrality of the Zionist movement. Turns out to be a good thing he did. So when this comes, by the way, it falls short of the goals of Weizmann. Weizmann is not ecstatic about the Balfour Declaration because the Balfour Declaration calls for, where's the exact terminology, a national home for, in Palestine, of a national home for the Jewish people. They wanted Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people. So this means that somewhere in Palestine there can be a national home. Not that Palestine is a national home for the Jewish people. Yet, this is seen at long last as the charter of the nations. There is permission now from the nations to begin to immigrate, to begin to build up. Now, you have to ask yourself a question. What does that have to do with the San Remo Conference? This is all in contradiction. The British did all of this basically at the same time. They were operating on multiple non-parallel tracks. This led to a great deal of confusion and a great deal of ambiguous interpretation, which the British liked. That was very convenient for them. It was not convenient for the Jews, and it certainly was not convenient for the Arabs. It would have been much better off, of course, had they said, this is our policy, love it or leave it. But they didn't do that. So they tried to please everybody. There was some reaction in Germany and in Turkey. There were calls for them to release their own version of the Balfour Declaration, again hoping to get Jews from other places to gain their sympathy in them. There was talk of that, but nothing ever came of it. Everybody recognized that it had already been done. There was nothing that the Germans could do, even though the German Zionists sent the Balfour Declaration to the foreign ministry, saying basically, we need one of these too, so that we don't lose the Zionist community around the world. There was an unexpected response initially from the Arabs. By the way, here's Nachum Sokolov on the passing of the Balfour Declaration. Sokolov was Chaim Weizmann's number one lieutenant in Great Britain. He was Eastern European as well. I love this writing. Midst storm and fire, the people in the land seem to be born again. The great events of time in Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah repeated themselves. The third temple of Jewish freedom is rising before us. Modern Israelis, in their writing, sometimes refer to the state of Israel as the third temple. Indeed, there's a famous passage where Moshe Dayan, in the early days of the Yom Kippur War, said, "I fear the third temple could be lost." You've heard that. It's in Howard Sacher's book. Weizmann continued to cultivate the ties of Arabs. He was no dummy. This is him with Sharif Hussein's son, Amir Faisal. And Hussein said, "The return of these exiles to their homelands will prove materially a spiritually experimental school for their Arab brethren, who are with them in the fields, factories, trades, and all things connected to the land." So there was an attempt at early Jewish-Arab, not rapprochement, because they hadn't been divided yet, cooperation. We're not going to see that again. Perhaps ever. Who knows? All right. Why, by the way, did the Brits give the Balfour Declaration? Any thoughts?
Appreciation for what he had done.
Appreciation for Weizmann. That was definitely part of it. There's a whole bunch of reasons. And in fact, Lloyd George says in his biography 20 years later that he thanked Dr. Weizmann by giving him the Balfour Declaration.
It was also a justification for the British seeking control over that area as a patron.
Absolutely. We talked about that with the Uganda scheme, that they wanted to have people that would do their bidding in the area rather than the natives, who might not.
He was also evangelical Christian.
Yes, many in the cabinet were. Smuts, Lloyd George, Balfour, and one or two others. They were Bible-believing Christians, and they thought that the Jews should be in the Promised Land. Absolutely. They were. There's a name for the English strand of evangelicalism, and I escapes me from the top of my head. A guy named Nelson Darby, a couple decades earlier, had formulated it. All right, anything else? It just made good sense from their perspective all the way around. By the way, if you want to just play a numbers game, you don't give the Jews Palestine. You know, get 700,000 Arabs and 85,000 Jews. It doesn't make sense. It had to be more than that. It wasn't just realpolitik. In fact, it was the opposite of realpolitik. And the previous government, which fell in 1916, wouldn't have done it. Right? This was a more liberal. These were the liberals as opposed to the conservative party.
Just one other point. There was also, as you talked about, with this the stereotype of Jewish power, the concern that Jews throughout Western Europe would support Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fight for loyalty, and there was always a suspicion
through Eastern Europe, through
of
Eastern
the loyalty
Europe, yeah.
of Jews, even in England, all through Western Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jews are still seen as second-class citizens, or they're still seen as aliens. And that's, by the way, why Zionism was so threatening to some of them. You remember earlier, Herzl had gone to the Baron Rothschild in France, that Baron Rothschild, and he wanted him to support Zionism, and Rothschild said, "Get out of here, this is ridiculous, I'm a Frenchman first. I'm not going to have my loyalty called into question." Dual loyalty is the issue. It's not until Brandeis comes along in 1915 and theorizes, you know, it's, you know, to be a good American is to be a good Zionist, is his famous quote. Does dual loyalty really kind of is it pushed into the open? But he recognized it as the big opposition factor for many people and attacked it. And it paid off tremendously for the Zionist movement in this country. So we now have a Balfour Declaration. We now have Weizmann saying, "I know there's going to be some problems, so we're going to have to figure this out pretty quickly." So he tries to strike up a friendship with Faisal. And what he does is eventually they come up with a formal agreement. This is the first Arab-Jewish pact. This is a tremendously promising and forgotten chapter in modern history, as far as I'm concerned. These are the points of their pact. Let me see if I can't remember if I put it in here. We'll get to it. Both parties will work together to encourage immigration of Jews into Palestine. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that today? Because why is Faisal doing all this? Any thoughts?
He wants the brains.
He's going to get that whole swath of territory, remember? It's okay if he doesn't get Palestine. You know, they're still going to, he's going to have some influence there. He's going to have good relations with Weizmann and the Zionists. And after all, the British are going to oversee the whole thing. He's going to get a vast amount of territory.
He wasn't a Democrat. He was an
imperialist. No, none of them were.
He wanted to replace the Ottomans with his own empire.
Absolutely, and hopefully it will be a benign empire, a benign leadership. But it would be under the tutelage of the British, which would be a little different. They barely had some power under the Ottomans. It was definitely a problematic relationship. All right. The Jews would protect the rights of Arab peasants and tenant farmers. Now, that's an interesting one, because when you start buying land up, you're not protecting the rights of Arab farmers, Arab peasants and tenant farmers. In fact, quite the opposite. When you start buying land, the price of land starts going up, and the Arabs can't have their own land. They certainly can't buy anymore. The Muslim holy places would be under Muslim control. Right? Reminds me of the Clinton parameters of December 2000. What's Jewish is Jewish, and what's Arab is Arab. So the Muslim holy places would be under Muslim control. That means the Dome of the Rock. Doesn't mean the Western Wall. It means the Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Oman. And there might have been some other places around the country as well. It would have been interesting to see what they would have done with the caves in Hebron, at the Machpelah, which is, has both a mosque and a synagogue in it. And, you know, that's problematic until today. The Zionist movement will assist Palestinian Arabs and the future Arab state. So there's a recognition of the Arab state to develop natural resources and establish a growing economy. So Faisal says, you guys are smart. I see what you've done with your farms. Your farms are better than the farms of our families that have been there for centuries. We want your help. We need your help. The boundaries between the Arab state and Palestine will be determined by the Peace Commission after the Paris Peace Conference. So there was a peace commission set up to conduct the Paris Peace Conference for the war. And I see some of you writing, so I'll pause a moment. Now here's a great one. The parties are committed to carrying into effect the Balfour Declaration calling for a Jewish national home in Palestine. Again, there's that ambiguity, a Jewish national home in Palestine. Is that, you know, a couple streets in Jaffa? Or is it all of the country? Finally, disputes will be submitted to the British government for arbitration. So we know who the big boss is going to be. And that's okay with us. So these guys met in 1918, then again in January 1919 in London. They actually liked each other. They had a friendship. They were photographed together, as we saw, several times. And I love the way that Weizmann went to visit him, and he put on the material. You know, it's not even Purim. All right, here's what Faisal said. Can I get somebody to read that? 2 weeks before signing his pact. Any volunteer? Make me read again. Okay.
Glasses?
You want me to read it? The two main branches of the Semitic family, Arabs and Jews, understand one another, and I hope that as a result of interchange of ideas at the peace conference, which will be guided by ideals of self-determination and nationality, each nation will make definite progress towards the realization of its aspirations. Arabs are not jealous of Zionist Jews and intend to give them fair play, and the Zionist Jews have assured the nationalist Arabs of their intention to see that they too have fair play in their respective areas. The Turkish intrigue in Palestine has raised jealousy between the Jewish colonists and the local peasants. The mutual understanding of the aims of Arabs and Jews will at once clear away the last trace of this former bitterness, which indeed had already practically disappeared before the war by the work of the Arab Secret Revolutionary Committee, which in Syria and elsewhere laid the foundation of the Arab military successes in the past 2 years.
Well, that sounds like a pretty promising future for Arabs and Jews in the region, doesn't it? Well, Faisal then wrote a little something in Arabic at the bottom. Basically said,
I lied.
This pact is null and void if the British don't fulfill their promise and give us a state. Guess what? Guess what happened? The British didn't give them the state. And indeed, the British and French fought back and forth over borders and who gets to control what. Unfortunately, it died a quick and painful death. And it is beyond a shame, to say the least, that that was not enacted. World history, certainly regional history, would have been dramatically different. There was still hope amongst the Arab elite at that time, or thought, that there could be a coexistence with the Jews in Palestine.
When you say Arab elite, what do you...
The rulers. Remember, his father was ruled the kingdom of Hejaz, which is ostensibly a section of Saudi Arabia, and he was really seen... They were direct descendants...
That tribe.
Yeah, they were direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. So they were really seen as elite in the community. So we all know what happened, unfortunately. And like I said, it was a big problem. By the way, what happened to Faisal? He was named the king of Syria by a Syrian conclave that got together, not to the liking of the British and the French. The French didn't like it, so they sent troops in, and just kind of the moment before they invaded Damascus to throw him out, he'd been there about a year, they surrendered, and the British gave him Iraq. He became the head of Iraq. And then another brother named Abdullah was given Jordan by the British. That was King Abdullah, who was the grandfather of King Hussein, and now the current King Abdullah of Jordan is named for him. So that family still rules in the Arab world, but they don't have the sway that they once had. The King Faisal was overthrown eventually in Iraq, and a democracy came into being, I want to say in 52, but I'm not exactly sure. I can't recall it directly. All right, a couple final notes on Weizmann. Weizmann, by the way, didn't become president of the World Zionist Organization or the Zionist Organization until 1920. During the war years, 1914 and 1918, he really was he was the head of everything in the Allies in that zone. But he really became the preeminent leader by the end of the war, and became official in 1920. He resigned in 1930 when the British changed immigration policies. He came back again in 1935. He was the head again until 1946. The truth was, his power began to wane in the late 40s. People like Ben-Gurion were taking more power away from him, and he was the grand old statesman. He eventually became the first president of Israel, a ceremonial position, which he held until his death in 1952. Has anyone ever been to his home there at the Weizmann Institute? It's really beautiful. If you ever have an opportunity, it's wonderful to take a tour of it. And you see his library, and it's really it's quite impressive.
Didn't they create the position of president for him specifically?
Yes. They absolutely did.
Almost an honorary post.
He didn't like Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion didn't like him. You should know also, one of the reasons it's said why Ben-Gurion declared independence on May 15th, 1948 is because Weizmann was in America and he couldn't sign the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. That's something I've heard. Whether or not it's true, I don't know. But it sounds like the two of them, if you read a little bit about them. They weren't really nice people, to say the least. All right. 1934, he helped create an institute in Rehovot. It was called the Daniel Seif Institute. It was a science institute. It was named in memory of the son of a friend of his from England. The son had passed away at the age of 18. And then by 1949, it was renamed the Weizmann Institute of Science. And it's located now right next to his home. His home is now formerly on the property of the Weizmann Institute of Science. All right, tonight we've talked about the successor to Herzl, World War I, the competing claims of the British, and Chaim Weizmann. Any questions? All right, thank you all very much. Next week we're dealing with, what are we dealing with next week? Socialism, I think.
Arthur Rubin.
Arthur Rubin, yeah. We're doing a lot of, yeah.
That's the December 17th.
Yeah.